everybody. Welcome to Banfield. No, I'm not Ashley. I'm Jesse Weber sitting in for Ashley. It's good to see all of you. So, got a lot going on tonight, starting with a star witness in the retrial of Karen Reed. It's not Karen Reed herself, no, though the jury's seen bits of her TV interviews and heard her texts and voicemails. No, today they heard from Jennifer McCabe, a former friend of both Reed and the victim, in this case, John O'Keefe. Now, McCabe was there when O'Keefe's body was found in the snow, and she's the author of that infamous Google search, how long to die in the cold, or how long to die in the cold. Did she search that before or after O'Keefe's body was found? That's the whole point. Just like in the first trial, she testified for the prosecution. And just like in the first trial, the defense claims she was in on a cover-up. And we're going to play you her testimony. By the way, they're still fighting over the timeline of that night as well, specifically how the victim's phone was apparently active, maybe after he was supposedly dead, kind of gives us a glimpse of whether he ever made it inside a house party that night, or was he killed and never made it inside. In this case, every second and every detail really does count. And I hope you don't need me to tell you this, but murder for hire is a bad idea all the way around. Horrible for the victim, of course, and also for the person who arranged it and almost always gets caught. Perfect illustration of that today is in Tennessee. A woman accused of hiring a killer has to sit in court and listen to her own voice on tape, allegedly making a deal with an undercover cop. Yes, you heard me right. An undercover cop. Listen.
How much are we talking? Something like this, about $5,000. Yeah.
I'm sorry I'm laughing, but he's not worth it.
Yikes. The price to murder her ex-husband was lower than she expected. What a bargain. Got the whole story. I'm going to play you a lot more of that murder for hire tape coming up. And later, a man accused of killing his wife and hiding her body says his murder indictment should be tossed out. Why? Because investigators can't find his wife's body. Is that how it works? Did the judge buy that argument? We're going to discuss it tonight. But first, let's start it off with what we need to talk about. Some trials are all about data. The evidence is technical, analytical, numbers on a chart. Some trials are all about stories, the witnesses, what they witnessed, how they acted then, how they act on the stand. And then there's the Karen Reed trial, right? Actually, Karen Reed trials, right? So today alone, day six of testimony in Reed's second trial for allegedly killing her boyfriend, the jury got everything I just described and more. The drama came from a prosecution witness named Jennifer McCabe reprising her testimony about the night John O'Keefe was either hit and killed by Karen Reed's SUV, as prosecutors claim, or was beaten to death inside of a house party where McCabe was also a guest, as the defense claims. Now, on the technical side, the defense put a ding in the prosecution's theory that the victim never set foot in the house where Reed dropped him off, because for one thing, his iPhone apparently showed he walked at least 36 steps. For another, the defense asserted it was possible O'Keefe unlocked his phone with Face ID and possibly looked at a text. And as it happened, that text was from Jennifer McCabe. On the stand today, just as she did at last year's trial, McCabe described Karen Reed as hysterical, screaming, repeating herself over and over when John didn't come home. She talked about the broken taillight on Karen Reed's Lexus. She claimed Reed said, "Did I hit him? Could I have hit him?" And when she described finding John O'Keefe in the snow, she seemed to tear up. Well, sort of. You be the judge.
When you see Kerry removing the snow from John's face, what do you do?
I was frozen. I was shocked. I couldn't believe that was him just lying there.
Tell us what you're seeing.
What do I see? I see Kerry just wiping the snow off. Karen had straddled him and had lifted her shirt and his shirt and was laying on him, and Kerry was screaming at her to get off of him. And I was literally just stunned. I mean, there he was.
What did John look like when you saw him?
I couldn't see much but his face, because the rest I could... was snow, and Karen was moving over him, but he just looked like frozen.
What did you do?
At first, I just stood there for a minute because I couldn't believe it was him. And then Kerry Roberts and I made eye contact, and I like knew. I was like, all right, I'm going to call 911. But I think I knew in that moment that John, you know, was dead.
Now, McCabe's testimony ended today just before her infamous Google search, how long to die in the cold, how long to die in the cold. There was a misspelling there. That's coming tomorrow, along with what's sure to be a really interesting cross-examination. Let's talk about it. I'm joined right now by Mark Bedereau, criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor who's been following the case since the beginning. He almost joined the defense team, in fact, and currently represents the blogger known as Turtle Boy, who's been covering the case. Mark, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate
it. Glad to be here.
Okay, so was today a major win for anybody?
I think the defense had a very good day today. Not so much with Jennifer McCabe, who's still on direct examination, so they haven't been able to establish anything with her yet. But the witness before her, the cell phone expert for the prosecution, a man named Ian Whiffen, who is supposed to be a very compelling and necessary witness for the prosecution if they're going to win this case. And what you had was the defense put some dents into the prosecution's case by having the witness concede that he could not exclude that John O'Keefe did not go in the house, that his phone did not go into the house. He established that John O'Keefe's phone was used at 12:32 a.m., which is important because the prosecution's theory is that he was struck and killed by a car at 12:31, and it begs the obvious question, how could he be using his phone, his Face ID, touching the side of it if he's already hit?
But just to press you on that, I mean, they also said the phone was inactive from 12:31, 12:32 until 6 a.m. And here's the thing. So Mr. Whiffen, I think, is an important witness. Why? A few things. So he said yesterday that it would be a reasonable assumption that the phone was by the flagpost, right? That was by the yard, meaning that the phone never went into the house. Also talked about the temperature of John O'Keefe's phone, that it started decreasing quite rapidly, which would indicate that the phone was outside and never inside the house. And if we say we're coupling the phone with John O'Keefe, it helps the prosecution say that John O'Keefe never was in the house. That felt like compelling evidence and something that the prosecution has been relying on, because I don't remember from the first trial, at least the battery evidence.
No, I don't think there was the battery evidence in the first trial, but I'm not sure it actually helps the prosecution as much as people think, because although the temperature clearly came down on the battery, it kind of levels out dramatically several hours later and drops at a much less rate of temperature drop, which may suggest it was actually in some other place, a garage or some other location, not just sitting outside. And the expert did his own test showing that a phone would drop precipitously, the temperature would continue to drop. But there's no explanation for why at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was, it would just, the rate of decline would stop dramatically.
So let's talk about phones for a second. Let's talk about Jennifer McCabe. Really, the big thing is how long to die in the cold. Now, the defense would say she looked that up at 227, yep, right, before John O'Keefe's body was discovered. She'd only be looking that up if she was part of the cover-up. She knew that he was dead. She was a part of it. Now, the prosecution put in evidence from this expert to say, wait a minute, she had opened up a tab earlier on in the day to look for something else. And you can use that tab to look something up at 6:30 in the morning or 6 in the morning. The timestamp would say, this timestamp wouldn't change, but it doesn't necessarily mean you look for that. You search for that at 2 something in the morning, which, by the way, if she really did search for that, she searches for that and then looks up the other miscellaneous things she's looking at. She's a part of a murder and then looks up, well, sports teams or things like that. That's the part that seems to me, at least, that seems compelling evidence that she had a window open but didn't really search for how long to die in the cold until after John O'Keefe's body was found. What's your answer to that?
Well, in the first instance, you have to consider the full context of the 227 search. There's going to be evidence, as there was in the first trial, that at 222 and 223, two other key witnesses, Brian Higgins and Brian Albert, were apparently butt-dialing each other back and forth.
That's weird. Yeah, I agree with you. It's weird.
And that's followed right after this alleged Google search. Now, the prosecution expert clearly says, look, it wasn't at 227. He's using his own program, by the way, that he created. The defense is going to have an expert who's going to say it was at 227 and it was a deleted search. One of only 4,500 approximate searches on her phone, one was deleted. It just happened to be that one.
But doesn't it seem like if she really was part of this cover-up, this murder, she'd be a little more panicked? Here's the part that I don't understand, okay, right? I don't understand the motive. And I know motive's not an element of a crime, and especially for the defense, they don't have to prove it. But I can understand the prosecution story here, that either Karen Reed was so upset at John O'Keefe, she deliberately backed up the SUV to run him over, might be shaky, or that she was heavily intoxicated, ran him over recklessly, realized she might have done it, you know, couple that with the idea of, did I hit him, did I hit him, questioning it. I don't quite understand what would be the motive for John O'Keefe to go in that house. There's some fight that breaks out. They beat him up, leave him to die, put him outside, and then, my goodness, they frame Karen Reed. And how lucky for them that she goes, you know, and says, you know, allegedly, I hit him, says things that implicate herself. It seems to me, I just don't understand what would be the reason that he would be killed by people in that house.
Well, you may not know the reason, but the framework of the defense starts with science before you even get to what happened in the house. They're going to have expert witnesses, biomechanical engineers, and people with degrees that could go on longer than our arms. And what these individuals are going to say is that there was no accident that's consistent with the damage on the vehicle and damage with the car. And certainly the science would control. And you have to also factor in the burden of proof here. The defense has no burden.
Sure.
Prosecution's got to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. If these witnesses are credible that there was no accident, then the rest of this is all excess.
I agree. And I've said this to you before we went on air. I cover cases all the time where you hear the defense say this is a tainted investigation, the investigators had tunnel vision. It's a common argument. This is the only one where I say you actually should really listen up. I think they were given a gift with Michael Proctor, okay? Lead
Certainly.
Investigator in this case, right? Completely sloppy, said horrible things about Karen Reed. I get it. But the idea that taillight would be taken and planted at the scene, that there would be this deliberate effort to frame Karen Reed. There's so much effort to be put into that. The jury might not need a motive, and they might not need an explanation, but don't they have to say, what's reasonable here, what's common sense?
You do, but again, you start with the science. If there is no car accident, but there are 45 or thereabout taillight pieces scattered along the lawn, then how did they get there? If it's not a natural consequence of a car accident, then they got there in some other way. And, you know, your first instinct is to say, come on, how could that be? But then you enter the world of Michael Proctor. And it's not just that he's sloppy, he's corrupt. I mean, he's terminated from employment because of his conduct in this case. He was found to have been biased in this investigation, amongst other things, beyond looking for nudes, beyond wishing that she would kill herself.
Horrible.
He was found to be biased, so it becomes more plausible. Is there a timeline that it fits? The evidence is going to show in this case that there is a timeline, and then you get to a series of text messages and behavior by Jennifer McCabe, Brian Higgins, Brian Albert, and others who begin texting each other in the days following in a way that is not natural or normal for people who are doing nothing but grieving the loss of their friend.
I agree with you. This is weird stuff, right? Yeah. Why did Brian Albert allegedly not come out of the house? Why was his house not searched? I get it. There's weird stuff. There's a lot for the defense to work with, and she's got great lawyers. Here's the part. Talking about Jen McCabe, right? She said how hysterical Karen Reed was, that she was screaming over and over, that Reed allegedly said, did I hit him? Could I have hit him? You couple that with Reed's statements that she did in the media, which are key pieces of evidence for the prosecution here, about speculating if she hit John O'Keefe. You couple that with the testimony of the first responder, Timothy Nuttall, who said, Karen Reed said, I hit him. It feels hard to square away why she would have said those things unless she might have had an indication she thought she hit him.
Well,
and let me just add one more thing. The testimony today, too, that while they're searching for John O'Keefe in the snow, Karen Reed says, there he is. How did she know where the body was?
Well, I don't know how she knows where the body is. They're driving there. She comes upon the scene. She sees it. But again, when you talk about statements of did I hit him versus I hit him, you have to consider the credibility of the witnesses. I mean, you take the first witness, the EMT Nuttall. He's a guy who the evidence showed testified a year before that he was as certain as anything that John O'Keefe was wearing a puffy coat like the Michelin man would wear, right? And it turns out he was wearing a light hoodie, and that he then said his memory got better a year later. Mm-hmm. I heard her say, I hit him twice after I met with the prosecution and another investigator. Now I heard it three times.
Yeah.
Then you heard Jennifer McCabe say today, well, Karen says everything in threes. I mean, it feels somewhat contrived.
What are you expecting from Jennifer McCabe's testimony tomorrow? What do you expect the defense to do?
Well, I expect them to expose a series of inconsistent statements that she's made over the course of the investigation. You know, you talk about, she says, I hit him and all these things. Her first statement to the police is nothing of the sort. That comes after the police leave and she meets with the family, has an epiphany, calls the police back and says, I think Karen said, did I hit him? And as the investigation went on and on, that kind of morphed into, I hit him. So I think, you know, that's certainly going to be a primary focus of her cross-examination, as is the text chain between these family members, which don't make sense. I mean, they bring witnesses to their house to be interviewed by Michael Proctor and other cops, and then they're live texting what's happening in these interviews, telling each other she's telling them everything. This is very
well. Wasn't that the idea?
Behavior.
She's telling them everything, like telling too much about the relationship between John O'Keefe and Kara Reid. Not that they had to do with the killing, but the idea, like you're talking about their dirty laundry.
I think that's a hard sell again, and you have to look at the full context of these messages. I mean, there are messages saying, "Tell them the guy, their close friend, by the way, but privately, tell them the guy never went in the house." That's a damning message. Why would these people say the story you've got to sell to the media is tell them the guy never went in the house? I mean, you saw Jennifer McCabe today appear to get emotional.
Yeah.
I'm not sure she did. I mean, it looked...
Well, second time she testified, you know, it's about a few years old.
Well, she said when she found him that she got all choked up,
right,
and nothing came out today. But when you listen to the 911 call, which will come in probably in her direct tomorrow, she's as cool as a cucumber.
Mm. Shock?
It's not her friend, John O'Keefe, lying dead on the lawn. It's a man.
Yeah.
And then when you see the dash cam video of the police car, she literally turns her back and appears very calm, cool, collected.
I hope everybody can follow this, by the way, because you and I know this case very well. I hope really we're explaining it perfectly to everybody. I want to know your opinion about the jury view. I'm torn about jury views, whether they're helpful or not. Going to 34 Fairview, Brian Albert's home, where John O'Keefe's body was found, do you think that helped the jury at all? And who did it help?
It helped the prosecution a little, only because of the timing of when it occurred. It occurred way too early in the case. None of the witnesses who were inside of the house or in that vicinity had even testified. If they had, I think that would favor the defense. I mean, you talked about Brian Albert not coming out. The windows that were his bedroom you could spit from those windows to the flagpole. It's that close if you've ever been to that yard. The jury doesn't know that right now, so they may not be taking that in. All these people inside who apparently didn't hear a car go screeching in reverse 25 miles an hour, smash into John O'Keefe, they didn't hear it, but we don't know. The jury doesn't know how far away that is, what happened. Nobody saw a body that should have been lying on the lawn. Literally, none of them. They all drove right by it with their bright lights pointing right where the body was. The jury may not yet have that in sight. So
snowplow driver didn't see it either, apparently.
Snowplow driver didn't see it either.
By the way, I'm pushing you because I know which position you take, so it's not necessarily, you know, I'm kind of divided about what I believe about happened. I think we both can concede. Big mistake for Karen Reid to do media interviews in the midst of an investigation before her retrial. How much of an effect do you think that's having on the jury, and why do you think she did it?
It's hard to tell how much of an effect it's having, other than to say at this point, it appears to be their strongest evidence, which is, again, why did you do it?
Because she basically says, she speculates, did she hit him?
It's a mistake to do those kinds of things during, you know, that are going to be used against you at a trial. Now, a lot of those videos were made during the first trial. I'm sure the assumption was there won't be a second trial, but there is a second trial, so there's no question it hurts. I can only assume that they chose to do it to just kind of get the story out to somehow favor them, but there's no question, at least as it's being used in the second trial, it doesn't favor them.
Do you think she's going to take the stand? She's been very vocal to the media outside court. She's been very vocal in these media interviews. She didn't take the stand the first time. I wonder, do you think she'll, what advantage would there be for her to take?
I don't think, first of all, it's unnecessary, and I think it would be too risky. And, you know, I'm obviously not counseling her on what she does, But no, I don't think she'll take the stand.
I have to ask you this question. You're free to not ask it any which way. I know you represent Turtle Boy. Anything you want to say about that? We talked before that you're limited in what you can say. Anything you can say about it?
No, I should keep those thoughts to myself.
That's fair enough. Yeah. That's fair enough. Okay, so what is another piece of prosecution evidence you're going to be looking out for? Because they talked about the battery evidence that was going to be important. Is there another piece of evidence that you're going to be looking out for the prosecution that the defense really needs to counteract?
Well, I think what's going to be interesting is the prosecution accident reconstruction person, because they know what's coming from the defense side. They have fought like hell to keep it out. Even today, they were there arguing these witnesses shouldn't be allowed to testify. So at the first trial, the person they used to do their accident reconstruction was a Massachusetts State Police trooper who, to be kind, was not a good witness. They've hired a private company. We'll have to see what they have to say. But again, they can't just neutralize the defense witnesses. They have to carry it and convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defense witnesses are bad. That's going to be a tough burden.
This is a tough case, let me tell you. We went through a lot of it. Mark Bedereau, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. All right, everybody. So before we move on, quick update, different case, quick update out of Pennsylvania. This is where prosecutors are defending the arrest of Luigi Mangione and the resulting search of his backpack, a search that turned up much of the evidence that prosecutors in New York, state and federal, are using to tie Luigi to the murder of insurance executive Brian Thompson. The defense says that the Pennsylvania takedown at an Altoona McDonald's was both illegal and unconstitutional. Now, the Commonwealth is saying, in fact, it wasn't. Prosecutors say police only approached Mangione because the McDonald's manager who called them said she was afraid of him, thought he could be the suspect. And when he told them his real name, it seemed to prove that his ID was fake and he was providing false information to law enforcement, i.e. probable cause. Now, a judge hasn't ruled yet, but we'll let you know when that happens. Okay, up next. You know why you don't hear about hitmen and murder for hire very often? Because they almost never succeed. The plotters or alleged plotters almost always get busted. This lady did. Well, police in Tennessee say she tried to arrange for someone to kill her ex-husband, and that someone was an undercover cop. Now, of course, the whole thing's on tape, which prosecutors were happy to play in open court just a few hours ago. You're going to hear it all right next, right after this. Got a bunch. Accusing her ex-husband, a former Tennessee news anchor, of causing the death of the couple's 18-year-old son. That was more than a year ago. Ashley had her on this show as a guest. But lately, Solomon's been in the news again for a very different reason. Why? A couple weeks ago, she was charged with solicitation to commit first-degree murder, legalese for allegedly hiring a hitman. And whom exactly did Solomon allegedly want hit? Her ex-husband, Aaron Solomon. Now, no such murder ever happened, thankfully, because as usually happens in these kinds of cases, the hired gun was an undercover cop who was wearing a wire. So when the alleged client told him she wanted Aaron Solomon, quote, under the ground and asked to pay for it out of a family trust after the fact, it was all on tape. And today, it was played in court. I want you to hear it and notice how surprised Solomon sounds when she finds out the price.
How much are we talking? Oh, something like this, about $5,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I'm laughing, but he's not worth that much.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry, but let me just tell you something.
It's a risk I'm taking.
I pray for hate.
Do you have any cash or anything? Can you go to an ATM or give me anything now?
I'm so broke.
You got any jewelry, anything of value that you could give me to...
I sold everything I owned the rest of the year.
What about giving me the registration until we settle this up?
That's what George and I talked about. I don't even have. I mean, I have the registration.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You're not talking about the, whatever that's called, the owner. Gosh, I'm afraid to get into the paperwork. I don't mind giving it to you, but I'm afraid to get into the paper with my name.
I'm afraid of getting stiffed. That's what I'm afraid of.
Now, tape or no tape, Solomon pleaded not guilty today, and the judge cut her bond in half from $500,000 to $250,000. I'm joined right now by my friend Lauren Conlon, host of the hugely popular true crime podcast, The Outlier, and Pop Crime TV on YouTube. Lauren, so good to see you.
Thank you so much.
I know this is difficult for you because you not only knew Angie, you had her on your podcast multiple times. What has this been like for you to learn this news? And I have to ask, was there anything in your conversations with her that would give you any indication she might allegedly do something like this?
No, there was nothing in our conversations indicating that she would allegedly do something like this. And I dedicated almost a year to investigating her son's death, which I still find to be very odd, and many people find it to be very odd. So I had a whole separate podcast centered around her family. And this family is, they've gone through a lot. Now, the death of Angie's son in 2020 was very sad, very mysterious to a lot of us. Her daughter, Gracie, went on YouTube when she was 14 years old and made allegations against her father. And Angie has made it very known that she believes that her ex-husband, Aaron Solomon, is behind her son's death. And her ex-husband has never been arrested, never been charged. But again, it's very well known. So I was shocked. I was sad. But my heart really goes out to Gracie right now. I mean, she should be focusing on, you know, her senior skip day or her senior pranks. And now she's got this to deal with.
Do you know how she's doing?
I mean, there were images of her in the courtroom today I saw on the stream, and she was sobbing.
Yeah.
She's very close to her mom, Angie and Gracie. You know, they felt like they were all they had when Grant passed away. And they were a very strong trio, Angie, Gracie, and Grant. So it's awful.
If you assume these allegations are true, the why is interesting. What would be the reason that she'd want to hire somebody to kill Aaron? Because she called it vigilante justice, and that the deaths of many people, including children, would be prevented by taking out her ex-husband. Can you explain what the motivation might be here, or at least what's being laid out by authorities?
That was interesting. She did make a lot of allegations about human trafficking on that recording, and I can't really speak to any of that, but I can speak to the fact that she made it very clear she was doing this for her daughter and for her son, because she believes that her ex-husband killed her son, and she believes that her ex-husband abused her daughter. And again, he has never been charged for any of this, but this is what Angie believes, and she does feel like no one has listened to her, law enforcement, you know, and just the public in general.
She had indicated, or allegedly indicated, she may have wanted two other people killed too. Do you know who those people might be?
It sounded like they may have been political, possibly. I mean, I did get an email from the courts after saying that they actually kicked her case over to the circuit courts, which kind of led me to believe that there possibly could be other charges coming if they get this in front of a grand jury. I mean, that was very scary. But no, I don't know any of the specifics behind that.
The judge dropped her bond to $250,000. Can she cover that? Do you know?
I don't think so. I mean, you heard her. She said that she was broke. And I mean, they have a fundraiser, but I think that's going to be very, very tough, Jesse.
Has Angie reached out to you since this has happened? Do you know if she's attempted to or anything like that?
No. And I actually hadn't spoken to her in probably a year. You know, life happens. It was tough for me to investigate this case all the way in New York. It's in Tennessee. But I have to say, this case right now, the murder for hire plot, I mean, it's serious. It's a Class B felony. That's 8 to 12 years in Tennessee. But I do think, after hearing this recording, if she had a good defense attorney, she might be able to poke some holes here.
What makes you say that?
Well, I never heard her say, "I want you to kill him." I heard her say, I mean, and look, she,
under
I felt
the
like,
ground, you know.
Well, she said he needs to be in jail or under the ground. And then the undercover TBI agent kind of led her a little bit. He was like, "Well, what do you want?" And then, you know, I felt like a lot of his questions were a bit leading, and she never gave him a title to her car. It was a registration. You can't transfer a car, you know, with a registration, and she didn't give him any money. So it's tough. I feel like there is some reasonable doubt there.
What is the online community saying? Because you're not the only one who followed this case. A lot of people, and when I say this, I mean about what happened to Grant. But what are people saying online about this?
I mean, it's mixed.
It is,
I'll be honest. There's a lot of people saying, well, This woman has been screaming for help for over a decade. No one's listened. I'm not surprised. And then there's the other side that's like, hey, they're both crazy. I do feel really, really bad for both Angie and Gracie. And I know that might be not the best thing to say right now while she is awaiting trial for a murder for hire plot. But I do feel like this family has been through it.
Was Aaron in court?
He was in court.
What was that like?
I mean, they kind of panned the camera over to him a few times. He didn't really make any type of expression. He kind of just sat there somber. But I know that, God, Gracie, when I told you, when they panned to her, she was a mess. And I don't think there was any communication between them at all. They don't speak. So it's tough.
What about, full circle here, the son's death, right? Grant's death. Is it still an active investigation?
Well, interestingly enough, on the 911 call, Aaron Solomon had mentioned three witnesses. And these witnesses had never come forward. And, it's been over 5 years. And I recently called the Gallatin police after getting some information that two of the three witnesses may have come forward. And it turns out they did come forward. What they said, and I received this updated report from the Gallatin police, it was a little confusing. They actually said that they saw Grant's truck go down this hill, and the next thing that they knew, they were kind of swerving out of the road because they thought the truck was going to go into the highway.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Grant disappeared underneath his truck, and he looked like a pretzel, they said. This was a little bit confusing for me because I spoke to the EMT, the first EMT that was on the scene. He never said anything about Grant looking like a pretzel. So again, I still have a lot of questions here.
I think a lot of people do. This is just another complex letter to this case. Lauren Conlon, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Good seeing you. All right. You can also, by the way, find her true crime podcast, The Outlier, everywhere you get your podcasts, and her YouTube channel. It's called Pop Crime TV. Hope everybody can check it out. Now, before we go to break, an update on another case that we've been following very closely. A judge in Brian Koberger's case has once again denied a motion to strike the death penalty. The defense had argued that the discovery produced by the state was so voluminous and disorganized that it violated Koberger's right to due process, but the judge disagreed. Trial is set to begin in August. Now, still to come, a big part of murder trials that usually doesn't get much attention, and that's proving a murder occurred. Oftentimes, it's obvious. You don't have to be a prosecutor to see it. But not always. And sometimes, there's not even a body. That is the case in Texas, where a suspect has the prosecution playing defense over an alleged victim they can't seem to find. So what does the judge think? We're going to go live to San Antonio next. Murder suspects on this show who thought they were free and clear because the victim's bodies were never found, meaning it can be tough for prosecutors to prove somebody was murdered if you don't really know what happened to that person, right? Except they can, and they did. And we're going to find out soon enough whether Brad Simpson will be convicted in Texas. And you may remember that name. He's charged with murdering his wife, Suzanne Simpson, who was last seen back in October fighting with Brad physically outside of their house in San Antonio. According to police, the day after that fight, Brad went to Home Depot, where he stocked up on trash bags, bleach, and bags of concrete. And on his way out, yeah, you know what he did? He allegedly asked for directions to the landfill. More than 6 months later, police say they have found other evidence pointing to murder, reportedly, including Suzanne's DNA on Brad's power saw. But they still haven't found Suzanne. And that is the reason Brad's lawyer wanted his indictment thrown out. It's a reasonable question. How do you defend against a crime that the state is only assuming took place? Well, the judge had a four-word response to that question today. Motion denied, indictment stands. I'm joined now by Sig Christensen, investigative reporter for the San Antonio Express News, who's been following the story from day one. Thank you so much for taking the time. Even though no body has been found, Suzanne's family, they had a funeral for her in December 2024, right? They believe that she is dead.
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of doubt about that. And if you were to poll them, I think most of them, if not all, would say Brad did it. Even his brother is not really taking his side in that. And that's just part of what's going on here. But, you know, nobody seems to doubt that he played a significant role in this. And as you've mentioned, and as I've got in my notes, there's a lot of evidence here linking him to her disappearance, at least.
Let's talk about that, because the defense wanted the case tossed, saying no body, but there's apparently a lot of other evidence. Talk to us about what that evidence is.
So there's a five-year-old girl. First off, there are witnesses, two people. And the five-year-old girl, his daughter, sees him hitting her, throwing her against the wall, hurting her elbow. He turned off his Suzanne's phone. She saw all of that. There's a neighbor just across the street, and I've talked with him a couple of times, and that fellow says that he saw them arguing outside their house. They were arguing loudly. It was after 10 o'clock in the evening. And on top of all of that, he saw them struggle. He later heard screams from a wooded area near the house. Now, I've walked through that wooded area, and boy, is that place like a little forest. And once you get in there, nobody can see anything. So the neighbor didn't see much, but he heard it. And then when you get past that, there's surveillance video as well. And the surveillance video doesn't look good for him. He goes to his daughter's school, a Whataburger in Bernie, a Home Depot. He buys disinfectant, Clorox disinfectant there. He buys concrete, heavy-duty trash bags, and you can see all this stuff in the trunk bed of his vehicle, of his pickup. At the Home Depot, he asks a person there, how do you find the local dump here? And the guy gives him directions. So the video then shows him leaving the dump site. And there's more. On the Bandera property, where I've been on several occasions, they find a burnt laptop, three cell phones belonging to Brad Simpson in the burn pit. Suzanne's DNA, as you mentioned, is found on Brad Simpson's power saw. Now, there's a case like this that ended in a conviction, Richard Ricardo Marquez. They found the body of Erica Gaitan. Well, they did. I take this back. They never found the body, just like his case. And there were other elements of that particular story that are extremely similar to this one.
You can get a conviction without a body. I've seen it happen before. But just going back to this for a second. So I understand as police have searched the landfill, they didn't find anything. You visited properties, as you talked about. Are there theories about what he could have done with Suzanne's body?
Not from the police. They've never talked to us. It's unfortunate that we have not had an opportunity just to sit down and swap thoughts. But they've been very tight-lipped from the beginning, and it was not just the local police in Almost Park. It's the DPS and all the other guys. They were never much help. So if you got theories, it's your own amateur sleuthing, and I have a few myself, but I'll keep that to myself and simply try to ask some questions. Maybe one of these days people will sit down and tell us what they know. I think where we're going to find out is going to have to be in a courtroom.
Real quick, 30 seconds, maybe one of those people who maybe speaks out is James Cotter. Can you talk to us real quick about his connection or alleged connection to this?
Oh, he's Brad Simpson's buddy. And there was a weapon that he was hiding for him. And my guess is that he's going to be used to turn evidence against Simpson. But I don't know what he knows.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever talked about what he knows. And if the families know anything, they haven't been talking to the media either. So we're all just in a state of waiting. And I think the waiting is going to come in trial. We'll see the evidence there.
And we'll see if we get more answers. Sig Christensen, thank you so much for taking the time. Appreciate it. And thank you for looking into the case.
Sure thing. Thank you.
All right. Still to come, the Delphi murders like we've never seen them before. I know you know the case. Two Indiana girls, best friends, killed while hiking on a railway bridge in 2017. It took 5 years to find a suspect, another two to convict him. And through it all, we, the public, barely saw any of the evidence that went before the jury. But now we can, and you will next. conversation. I got something else for you, though, because it's been said that a parent can give a child no greater gift than good manners. But tonight, I can think of some parents that probably should have spent less time on pleases and thank yous and more time telling things like, you know, armed robbery, not very polite either. Los Angeles 7-Eleven clerk can speak to that firsthand after he was robbed last week by a suspect who did his best to remember his P's and Q's, or even as he racked a gun at the terrified cashier.
Huh? You know, all the money, bro, all the money. Cool. Nah, just the money. That's it, just the money. I don't want to kill you, just the money. Right? That's it, all right? You're my guy, all right? I just want the money, all right? Okay. No, relax. You're okay, right? They come? I just want the money, everything. You just give me the bottom, the hundreds, right? The hundreds, right? No? What about this one? Please, brother, please. Please, brother, hurry, brother. This one. I want this one. I'm a nice one. I'm not going to do anything. I just want that. That's all I want. No issues, brother. Everything. Is that a bait?
Have a good night. Well, the police were able to nab three of the four suspects. Fourth one, maybe not too tough to find. Maybe he's going to be wearing a mask, helping a little old lady across the street. Sounds about right. Does it for us here on Banfield, everybody. I've been Jesse Weber filling in. Thank you so much. Cuomo starts next.